to Fancy Town Crimes Podcast, a podcast about crimes in fancy towns told by middle-class broads.
All right, well, hello, everybody.
Hey, guys.
This is Megan.
And this is Taylor.
And it's Fancy Town Crimes.
Woo!
And we have
We're back,
missed,
baby.
I know. I was going to say, we have missed you. I have missed recording.
I know, me too.
As much as I think it's good that we're taking a little bit more time to make sure we're bringing better quality stuff to the table, I miss it because I think of so many things. I'm like, oh,
I know.
God, I can't wait to talk about this. And then I immediately forget everything I want to talk about.
Totally. Well, actually, the fact that you just said that was the JonBenet TikTok that you sent to me the other day. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I don't know the girl's name, but I can totally look it up and tag her. But that was really interesting. So if you haven't seen this TikTok, she basically was in a class where a psychologist who didn't work on the case, but like knew of the case,
I thought he did work on the case. Didn't she say it was an investigator that worked on the case?
So I went back and I listened to some future ones that she did after she did that one. And she was basically like, I wasn't expecting this to blow up. And she was like, if I had known it was going to blow up, I would have described things a little bit better. So he didn't actually work on the case, but he was somehow connected. But so he talked about how the whole broken window thing, which I think we did talk about in our episode of JonBenet, mm-hmm. that the father, a couple of weeks before, they had locked themselves out of the house. And so the father went in through that basement window to get into the house. So it did look like forced entry. However, it was because of the father. That previous time, who knows if perhaps maybe a close family friend or somebody knew that this was knew that was going to be easy to get into and then went in through it. But anyway, I will link her TikTok stuff down below because it was really interesting and just love some additional info about JonBenet.
Yeah, it was cool. Also, I looked it up. Her name is Sid Brody, at Sid Brody. So that was pretty cool to see.
Perfect.
Oh, well.
Anyway, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about.
It has been like a hot minute.
Yes.
Which I appreciate. How has your life been in the last, I don't know, 3-4 weeks?
Wild. So we are in the process of buying a house. We close in 2 weeks. And I've packed 4 boxes. Guys, it's not going well. But yeah, how about yourself? You just took a very fun trip.
I did. I went to Seattle and Portland and
so fun.
Loved every second of it. I gotta say, you guys in Seattle and Portland, you like know what's up. And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Actually,
for sure.
Funny enough, when I was in Portland, so first of all, we're like pulling into the train. The people on Amtrak, like the people who work on Amtrak, are mm-hmm. freaking hilarious. They're like telling jokes over
That's
the
awesome.
PA system. And I was like, this is such an interesting trip. So of course, it's like, you know, that stay weird Portland. It's
yes.
like you can't walk backwards eating ice cream on a Sunday, you know, goofy stuff like that. So I get off the train in Portland. Oh, and first of all, there was drama going on behind Brandon and I. Like
drama.
Like these two women, it was a mother and daughter, were literally unpacking years of trauma behind us. I was like,
that's aggressive.
No, listen, I like the tea, but it was a little too much tea for me. I was like, Brandon and I are just sitting there in silence, like staring at each other. They're like crying behind us and yelling. And I was like, okay.
So uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully they're doing okay. I really do wish them the best. Hopefully they're doing okay.
Seriously. Sending good vibes their way.
Oh, God. But I get off and everybody in Portland looks like all of like it basically it kind of was like a city of misfits almost. It was like, do you not totally fit in where you are? Come to Portland. And I was like, I belong
love that.
I was like, normally I'm one of the few people that has their hair dyed. Mm-mm. I was like one of the few people that didn't have their whole head dyed.
That's so cool.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
so awesome.
It was like the stuff of my little scene queen dreams in high school. Literally, that's what I feel like. All the emos moved to Portland, and I loved every second of it. Gosh
darn it. I need to, I can't believe. So, fun fact about me, listeners, in my previous life, my previous career life, I used to go to Seattle like, I don't even know, like every other week.
It was a lot.
It's a very far flight if you're going every other week. But I never made it out to Portland, which, like, what the heck? Why did I go all the way there and not go to Portland?
Oh, the food is really, the food trucks, amazing. Like, Brandon and I kind of became addicted to food trucks.
Love that.
It's so lovely. But I really loved Seattle. I really loved Portland. I loved Seattle too. Though Seattle, my friends, why the hell does everything close at 8 p.m.? I need someone to let us know
why that is.
We were starving at 8 p.m. and there was nowhere to go. And I didn't end up eating until 11 p.m. at like some dive bar. It was a good dive bar, but I was like, it's 3 a.m. my time. It is 11:30, quarter of 12 here. I am dying. But yeah, I looked it up. I couldn't find anything. So we have a couple of people who listen in Seattle, and please, please tell us because we're desperate.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I would wonder why.
But also, I mean, gorgeous state. Oh yeah. My god, it reminded me a lot of Rhode Island actually when we were driving through. It's kind of Rhode Islandy because it's all the little, like, you're driving over a bridge every 2 seconds.
True.
Underground tour.
Oh, the best tour. If you've ever been to Seattle, or if you've never been, if you live there and you've never done the underground tour, highly recommend.
Clay was our guide.
I think it might have been the same guy.
It might be, because I don't think it's a large business, but Clay was so funny.
So was it the underground tour that's like across from the Starbucks? It's in that like little, so, well, I mean, everything's across from a Starbucks because it's Seattle.
It looks like an abandoned building.
Because
that's kind of what it looked like to me.
So it was like a, so out front of the building where it started, it's like a, there's kind of like a, an open area where there's like benches and it's all brick. And then
yes.
Okay. Yep. So same place.
It was Bill Spidell's, I think.
Yep. It was like off of like a bar or something, or underneath a bar, or you walk in through a bar. I don't know. I remember something about a bar.
But Seattle was amazing. Loved it. Portland, loved it. You guys rock out there. And Brandon must have said to me like 7 times, we are not moving out here. Probably because he just moved into my house like a week ago.
He's like, I can't move again, guys.
No, but it was because his job, there's not really many out there, but you know, who needs a job?
Who needs jobs?
Who needs a work?
Let's not have jobs. Let's all just like live life and just do the things that we enjoy rather than, you know.
I wish too.
That's why we're here.
So, funny enough, I gave you 3 potential things that you could research for today.
Yes.
What did you go with?
So, I ended up choosing Seattle because I have the most connection with Seattle. So, I decided to go in that direction. Is that okay?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, no, I said Seattle, Portland, or an airline. Do you have a guess as to what? I'm really curious if you have a guess.
So I'm thinking it has something to do with like maybe a hijacking or something. You're giving me crazy eyes, so maybe that's a yes, just because you kept like alluding to the airport. So let me tell you about Seattle, then we can jump into your case, because I'm so curious.
Can
now
you tell that I'm excited?
Yes, Megan, you can't see Megan's face right now, but she's about to burst open.
Well, you might be able to see me on YouTube.
That's true. You can see her face on if you go watch us on YouTube. So Seattle is a seaport city on the west coast of the U.S. It is the seat of King County, Washington. With a 2019 population of 753,000 people, it is the largest city in both the state of Washington and the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So the Seattle metropolitan area population is 3.98 million. So it's a lot of people, making it the 15th largest in the U.S. So between 2013 and 2016, Seattle was rated the fastest growing major city and remains in the top 5 as of May 2015, with an annual growth rate of 2.1%. In July 2016, Seattle ranked as the fastest growing major U.S. city with a 3.1% annual growth rate and continuously among the fastest growing cities in the U.S. It's a very interesting city, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this here, but I feel like it's similar to San Francisco in a lot of ways because it's very expensive to live in Seattle. It has a very large population. There's lots of huge industry there, but there's a ton of wealth inequality and a lot of people who are homeless. So I'll talk about that a little bit more. So Seattle's population historically has been predominantly white, and the 2010 census showed that Seattle was one of the whitest big cities in the country, although its proportion of white residents has been gradually declining. So in 1960, whites constituted 91.6% of the city's population. Then in 2010, they constituted just 69.5%. So that's like that's a pretty big decline. Mm-hmm. So approximate as of the 2006-2008 American Community Survey, approximately 78.9% of residents over the age of five spoke only English at home. Those who spoke Asian languages other than Indo-European languages, not exactly sure what an Indo-European language is, but they made up 10.2% of the population. Spanish was spoken by 4.5% of the population. And those that spoke Indo-European languages made up 3.9% of the people who spoke over five.
So Indo-European languages, it says that it's native to Western and Southern Eurasia.
Interesting.
So let's see. Oh, things like Sanskrit, Hindi, Farsi, Greek, Baltic languages. Yeah.
Fascinating. All right. Well, you learn something new every day. So Seattle's foreign-born population grew 40% between 1990 and 2000. So that's just over 10 years. It grew by 40%. The Chinese population in Seattle, in the Seattle area, has origins in mainland China, Hong Kong, Southeast Asia, and Taiwan. So basically everywhere in the west of the United States is like known as like the gateway to Asia. That's how it's often referred to in like corporate settings. Like, so a lot of companies will set up shop in locations like San Francisco, Seattle, because they see it as the quote unquote gateway to Asia. It's a very kind of strange thing, honestly, but you can see that huge growth. And I guess it had paid off for some of those companies and hopefully for the people who actually came to those areas. Deep bap boop, bada bap bap. So it is estimated that King County has 8,000 homeless people on any given night. Oof. And many of those live in Seattle. So if you have ever been to Seattle, it's very noticeable. So unlike like San Francisco has a very high homeless population as well. The interesting thing about San Francisco is I feel like it's like relegated to like one area of the city. Whereas in Seattle, it is, you'll see homeless people everywhere, like all over the city. It's really sad. Just like, it's very sad.
Well, and the thing that I noticed, which I've actually never really seen before, is like tent cities almost.
Yeah. Yep.
And I was talking to Brandon about it a little bit when we were there, because I was like, wow, I've just like never seen that before.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes sense, because if you think about where we see a homeless population, it would be in Massachusetts is mostly who we would interact with.
Yep.
You can't survive in a tent.
Correct.
In Mass. Like, you literally cannot survive. Yeah,
it gets too cold.
It was, sadly, I almost wonder if there's more of a homeless population out west because you can survive a winter versus don't know how you survive a winter outside in New England if it's a bad winter.
Absolutely. I did some research. So when we were in Seattle, actually, while we were literally sitting in that Starbucks across from the Underground Tour, there was a big encampment of homeless people across the street. And I remember sitting there with Jeff, and I was saying to him, like, this is so sad. Like, it's so interesting that you don't see this where we live. And mm-hmm. we went through the motions where we said all the things that you just said. We were like, yeah, like you can't survive. It's very warm, or it's much warmer here than it is, you know, back home where it's freezing. And so we also did some research into like, why is there such a big homeless population here as opposed to like, or that we can see, right? And so a lot of the research that I found when it came to the homeless in the area is there is help, but their programs are surprisingly just like not as robust. But also, I think this is horrible. We're better at hiding it here. Mm. So it's like, it's this like double-edged sword, multi-reason, you know, it's just awful. And the other big piece in Seattle is, at least when I was there, it was like right around the time that Amazon had like set up, like they had just like bought like half of the world down there, and there was a lot of upset about it like pushing people out of certain areas, like basically like pushing people out of their homes because it was mm-hmm. jacking, like causing the prices to rise, and it was increasing the homeless population, and there was no funding being given to like what they were doing that was damaging the city. So it's a lot, guys. There's a lot of reasons, but yeah. Just, you know, it's very sad. So anyway, moving on from the sadness. So Seattle has a notably large lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. According to the 2006 study at UCLA, 12.9% of the city residents polled identified as gay, lesbian, or bisexual. This was the second largest proportion of any major U.S. city behind San Francisco. Greater Seattle also ranked among second in U.S. metropolitan areas, with 6.5% of the population identifying as gay, lesbian, or bisexual. According to 2012 estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau, Seattle has the highest percentage of same-sex households in the United States at 2.6%. Yeah, surpassing San Francisco. The Capitol Hill District has historically been the center of LGBTQ culture in Seattle.
Also a lot of fun bars.
I would believe it. Let's see here. So according to the ACS one-year estimates, in 2018, the median income of a city household was $93,000, and the median income for a family was $130,000. 11% of the population and 6.6% of the families were below the poverty line.
11%, you said?
11%.
Wow. That is a huge wealth disparity.
It is a huge wealth disparity. Of the people living in poverty, 11.4% were under the age of 18, and 10.9% were 65 or older. Ugh. So very sad. So as of 2019, the median income for roughly 345,000 households inside Seattle city limits hit 102. So it actually went up between 2018 and 2019. So that's up to $9,000. So the median is telling us that more than half of the households in Seattle have six-figure incomes now.
Wow.
So if you earn less than 100,000, you are now in the minority.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So as per realtor.com, the median asking price for a home in Seattle was roughly around $765,000 as of May 2021. So that's up 5.5% year over year. So the median sale price was actually even higher at $858,000, just because that's how things are right now. Everything's going for like $100,000 over asking. So the drink of Seattle is the Old Pal.
Oh.
Yes. So the Old Pal is a rye drink. So it is 1 ounce rye whiskey, 1 ounce Campari, 1 ounce dry vermouth, and garnish with a lemon twist. So before we jump into our case, go ahead and make yourself that. And that is my introduction to Seattle.
I dig that a lot. Actually, remember we talked about the Negroni before?
I literally was just about to say it is, beep up, where did it go? Oh no. It is a variation of a Negroni.
Oh my gosh. See, I didn't get a Negroni, but one of the people we were visiting got a Negroni. And no. We were at the flipping table and I was like, Brandon, they got a Negroni. We talked about that on the podcast. He's like, Megan, oh my God, can you chill for 7 seconds?
That's incredible.
Oh, Lord. Well, so one of the places that we went in Seattle on the last day, so we were taking a red eye home. Do not ever recommend that, but we will probably do it again.
No, I've done it before. I actually fell asleep in the airport before my flight boarded, and they did last call. I woke up as they were closing the doors. I fell asleep on my lap, like head in my knees. I was so flipping tired, and I ran up and I was like, wait, are you? And they were like, we already did last call. And I was like, I was literally sitting in front of you with my head in my lap sleeping, and they let me on. I was so frantic, but I got on there and a bunch of people were talking about New York, and I was like, oh crap, am I on the wrong flight? I was not. I ended up in Boston. I sat down in my seat and was like, you know what? If I'm going to New York, I'm going to New York. And I just fell back asleep.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Don't take a red eye. It's not fun, especially on a flight that long.
Oh my God. So we had to kill some time before our flight because we get this right. So we had flown into Seattle. We took the train to Portland because we were visiting some of Brandon's friends. So we went to Seattle first to visit a friend, Portland to visit another friend. And we were like, oh, we'll just fly out of Portland. The flight out of Portland was so expensive because we had a layover in Seattle. And I was like,
ridiculous.
I was like, forget it. We're taking the train back. Like, I'm not going to spend an extra like $300 when I can spend like $100 to get back.
Fair enough.
On the train. And the train is a beautiful ride. 100%.
Yes.
So we go back. We're like, what do we do? Like, it's a Monday. And we ended up at the Museum of Flight, which is close to the airport in SeaTac. Highly recommend. Museum of Flight was so cool. Absolutely so cool.
I'm trying to remember. I don't think we...
It was close to the airport. It was in Tukwila. I think it's called Tukwila.
Okay. That's so cool.
So Brandon turned into an 8-year-old boy, and it was very adorable because he was so excited. So I'm going to show you a couple of pictures.
He got to sit
in this type of plane that I don't 100% know, but he was so excited to sit in that plane. I'm sorry. Look at that face. He's so happy. He's over the moon. I then got into that seat to like hang out, and some 8-year-old boy, I swear, almost threw me out of it. Like, he came over like he owned it and was like, get the fuck out. And I was like, oh my goodness.
That's incredible.
But one of the cooler things that we did was you can tour through some of the planes, and we toured through the Concorde, I think. Mm-hmm. Is the one that went, did that one go to space? I think it's the British Airlines one, the Concorde.
I'm looking it up.
I think it is. But we toured through the Concorde. And as we were touring through the Concorde, my booty did not fit through the aisle.
No.
So for listeners, you guys don't know this. I've been in really great shape in my life. I've been in not so great shape. I've been in the shape I am now, which is somewhere in the middle. My butt has always been a force to be reckoned with, no matter what shape that I'm in. So I'm literally walking through the aisle and I have a picture. I got like kind of stuck.
Oh my God. That is incredible.
I had to like shimmy through. Brandon was killing himself. I'm like, take a picture. I had to like shimmy through.
Hey, white girl, where'd you get your booty from?
Oh my God, that story. Yes. So we were like in Boston, just minding our own business after breakfast, walking down the road, And some man from what felt like three blocks away.
Some man.
Just kept yelling at me.
Yes.
White girl, where you get your booty from?
Yep.
Sir. Sir. Please. Sir.
It is, sir.
Please, I stop. Don't know, okay? I don't know where it came from.
So, I actually, interestingly enough, the only time that I have ever been catcalled that I actually was not offended by it happened in Seattle. I don't know that I would even qualify this necessarily as catcalling because it was definitely a gay man. And I was walking across the street headed to work, and he was sitting at a red light in his car. And he stuck his head out the window and he went, he said, "Yes, girl, you do your thing." And I was like, "Yes, I will do my thing. Thank you, sir."
I would call that a little cheerleader.
It was. He was my personal cheerleader that morning. And I had a really good day at work that day because of his generosity at throwing a beautiful thing my way. Now, if you're going to quote unquote catcall, be a cheerleader instead and do that. That was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a difference.
There's total difference. There's a
clear difference.
Yes. Yes. He did not make me feel uncomfortable. He definitely was just trying to be a nice person. There's a big difference.
Fair. 100% fair.
Anyway.
So as we were walking around and touring those planes, it's like the longest story ever. they had a placard or a little like informational box about D.B. Cooper.
Oh my God.
And I wanted to do it. I had originally planned something else. Poor Taylor had to change on a dime for me because they flew, DB Cooper, the flight flew from Portland, Oregon to Seattle, Washington.
Yes.
So this, I'll read it to you at the end because it's cool. But essentially, I have a lot of sources. There's a really cool documentary on HBO. And it's called The Mystery of D.B. Cooper. That's where I got most of my information. I also got info from FBI.gov, a real source.
Ooh.
A Rolling Stone article by Andrea Marks. Another Rolling Stone article by Amelia McDonald Perry. Crimemuseum.org. Check6.com. And then the Museum of Flight, where we went. And Wikipedia, of course. Duh.
Of course.
So on November 24th, 1971, which was Thanksgiving Eve, Northwest Orient Flight 305, which was a Boeing 747, departed from Portland at 2:50 p.m. en route to Seattle, Washington. The flight had a crew of six, including flight attendants Tina Mucklow, Florence Schaffner, Captain William Scott, and co-pilot Bill Radizak. Poor Bill. He's still alive, too. He was so cute in that documentary, and I can't pronounce his name. I'm sorry, Bill.
Sorry, Bill.
So there were also 36 passengers, one of whom was using the alias Dan Cooper. He would hijack the flight, and it would be the only unsolved act of air piracy in U.S. history.
Crazy, yes.
So D.B. Cooper is actually not the name that he used. It's some like weird epitaph that somehow got put in with his name. He went by Dan Cooper.
Okay.
But for the sake of this, we'll call him Cooper, D.B. Cooper. So he bought a one-way ticket in cash to Seattle. How did he get on the plane and hijack it, you ask? Because there was literally no security.
Yeah, nope.
There was no TSA, no metal detectors.
That didn't really happen until 9/11, right?
No, we had metal detectors and stuff.
Okay.
Actually, that's a story for another day, but I flew out of Logan 5 or 6 months after the attacks as a child. Yeah. It was wild. It was so different.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, like I remember walking by an armed army man, essentially, with like a very large, what I can assume was an automatic weapon. And my dad was like, "Just keep walking, it's fine, don't worry, we're going to Disney." I'm like, "Okay."
You're like, "Okay, Disney's great."
So anyway, there was no TSA, none of that. Basically, you would walk out onto the tarmac, you would show them your ticket, and you would just walk right up those steps onto the plane. So one passenger, Bill Mitchell, was on his way home from college. He ended up sitting in a row very close to Cooper, and he was one of the people that the FBI, you know, he helped them do the sketch and all of that stuff. And but one quote was kind of funny. So he noticed Cooper was wearing sunglasses on the flight, and he thought to himself, "That's not very cool." just love it. Dude, you're not as cool as you think you are.
You're not that cool, buddy.
Hijacks just, plane.
Just wait. Not that so, it's cool to hijack a plane, but just this story of DB Cooper's.
Also, well, this might be the first case that I do that no one dies. No one dies.
I think you're right.
So we can laugh at this shit all day long because no one dies. Okay. Flight attendants were serving drinks to passengers before takeoff, and that was something that was unique to that particular airline, kind of like a luxury thing. A man at the back of the plane, Cooper, ordered a bourbon and slipped a note to the flight attendant, Florence. She slipped it into her pocket thinking nothing of it because it was common for men to hit on the flight attendants. Yes. So they were literally seen as like sexy in the sky.
Well, did you listen to the most recent Wine and Crime episode about okay, so the most recent two episodes ago, so Dick Wolf, who is the yes, exactly, SVU, he wrote this, let me look it up, Dick Wolf, what's it called, airline quote, he like wrote, put together this, he worked for like the airlines, and he came up with this quote about what at the time were called stewardesses.
Yeah.
And I'll have to look, I'll let you know when I find it, but go ahead and continue. But this basically set the tone for like how these women were sexualized in the sky. But anyway, continue.
Oh yeah, no, like they were talking about how they had to sign an agreement. They wouldn't weigh over a certain amount, they wouldn't gain a certain amount of weight.
Yes.
If they were pregnant, they had to resign.
It's ridiculous.
Dude, they were literally there to be like, you know, cute little things. And actually, I learned at the Museum of Flight, flight attendants, called stewardesses at the time, started out as nurses. Like that, there was this woman.
I forgot about that.
I forget what her name was and I feel really bad, but she was a nurse and she was also a flight attendant, and she convinced this airline that you should hire nurses, like just in case some shit goes down and whatnot. And that's kind of where it started from. So God love those flight attendants. They have to deal with so much. Oh, I don't envy you at all.
I got it. So the quote was, or the campaign for National Airlines was, "I'm Cheryl, fly me."
Oh my God.
Yeah, disgusting. I can't even.
Oh goodness, that makes me cringe.
So gross.
Okay, so she put it in her pocket because she thought nothing of it. She's like, "I'm fucking hot and this guy knows it." Well, he was hijacking the flight, unfortunately. And so she passed by again and he was like, "Dude, you really need to read that note." And so she's going back to the jump seat. She reads the note. Tina Mucklow goes back to her jump seat. They're literally about to take off and they're taxiing down the runway. And Florence shows the note to Tina, and it's a ransom note demanding $200,000 in negotiable currency, which is like, you know, 10s, 20s. It might even just be 20s. Four parachutes and a refuel truck. Now, 200,000 in 71, I think is like over $1 million now.
Wow.
Maybe you should double check that for me.
Okay, what was the amount again?
200,000.
I'm pretty sure. One more time.
71.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure they said it was over $1 million, but I digress. So, she showed it to Tina, and then Tina was basically like, "Oh shit," like, and she lets the pilots know that there's an emergency on the flight, and they're like, "Oh shit, we're in this too much, we can't abort the flight, we have to get up in the air." So they fucking take off.
$1.3 million.
Oh my goodness, that is some money.
That is a lot.
So I've seen some differing reports on which flight attendant sat next to Cooper, but on the documentary, Tina talked about how she sat next to him, so I'm gonna go with her since she was there.
Sure.
He showed her the bomb in his suitcase. To her, it looked like dynamite strapped together with electrical tape, wires coming out, and he had his hand on a trigger. Fucking terrifying. She sat next to him throughout the flight, lit his cigarettes so that he didn't have to take his hand off the trigger.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. At some point during the flight, Tina asked Cooper if he had a grudge against the airline. He said no, but he does have a grudge. at a press conference after the flight, she did say he was actually a kind person. He was never rude, mean, anything like that. Just business as usual, I guess. Tina let the pilots know what happened. When the pilots were up in the air, they called the head of their company in Seattle, who immediately got the FBI involved. Now, it was only like, I think the flight was about 30 minutes. A couple places said it was an hour. Regardless, it's a very short flight. It's like Boston to New York. It's a short, short flight. So there was not a lot of time to collect the ransom money, the parachutes, all of that. They actually had to circle in the air for 2.5 hours or 2 hours because they needed time to get all this stuff. Because he picked the shortest flight to do this. So in order to prevent the passengers from getting nervous, they made an announcement that there was some type of mechanical error, that they needed to burn up some extra fuel and they would be circling the airport prior, to, you know, deal with it, but it wasn't a big deal. The crew was able to play it so cool that none of the passengers were aware the flight was hijacked until money was brought on board after they landed.
That's
incredible.
Good for them for being able to like keep it so cool. That's incredible.
So Cooper made it clear that he didn't want any bills that had sequential serial numbers. The FBI complied, but they made sure that there was an L in front of all of the serial numbers so that they could trace it. They were able to purchase parachutes from a local skydiving school. Oh, they had to like go to this contact the owner of the skydiving school because it was closed. And he's like, all right, I guess I'll sell you some parachutes. And they're like, thanks. We really need them like now. So the flight landed a few miles from the SeaTac airport at 5:45 p.m., which was 2 hours after its scheduled landing. Tina was responsible for getting the money and the parachutes from the tarmac and bringing them on the flight. When Cooper was satisfied he had what he needed, he allowed all of the passengers off of the flight, as well as two flight attendants and the flight engineer. He stayed on board with the two pilots and Tina. Cooper told the pilots that they were to fly him to Mexico at 10,000 feet with flaps and landing gear down. Now, they, with the parachute and with those instructions, they were like, he's going to jump out of the plane. Like, we know he's going to jump out of the plane. They were concerned that because there were four parachutes, he was going to make them jump too.
That's so scary.
They didn't have to, which was good.
Yes.
So since that flight would take longer than normal because they were only getting up to 10,000 feet, I think it was because at 10,000 feet, you don't have to pressurize the cabin. And he didn't, it would be, if he opened the back stairs, there'd be a rush of wind inside because of the differences in pressures and whatnot. So he didn't want that. He wanted the same pressure. So it was easier to jump out. But flying at 10,000 feet, it's going to take a lot longer. So they agreed that they would need to stop in Reno for a refuel. Tina stayed with him at the back of the plane as they took off for a second time. It's also important to note that at this time, hijackings weren't super uncommon. Like, they were a thing that happened. Most of the time, it was people wanting to get to Cuba. The flight would land in Cuba. Passengers would get off, get cigars and rum, and head home.
I can't.
What?
What?
And so in the documentary, the co-pilot, Bill, he's like, oh, maybe this guy wants to go to Acapulco. That beats Seattle on a rainy night. And I'm like, dying. Like, these people are like Silver Lining City over here.
Oh my gosh.
So somewhere between Reno and Seattle, Cooper jumped. They never made it to the refueling spot. He was concerned about how he would open the back stairs and get out. At first, he couldn't get them down because there was too much wind. So at this point, also, Tina had gone up to the cockpit. They're all in the cockpit. He's like, don't come out of the cockpit, basically. But you can also, like, on a flight, you can, you know, radio into the cockpit. So I guess he's trying to get the stairs down, and he's radioing, like, there's too much wind. I can't get the stairs down. And I don't know why this is so funny to me, but it's just, it's like this guy who's so calculated. He's like, I can't get the stairs. And I can just imagine, like, you know, your parents back in the day, like, yelling to each other, like, Barbara, right? I can't get this. And just open it. That's all I So they ended up slowing down, and he was able to get the stairs down. And then sometime between 8 and 8:30, they felt a big pressure bump in their ears and, like, the plane shift a little bit. And the pilot said, the captain, said, "Mark your screens. I think our friend just took leave of us." So he had, in fact, jumped at that point. Because they didn't have exact coordinates, it made trying to figure out where he landed really hard. So the FBI created a task force called NORJAC, which included Army battalions, local police, and even Boy Scouts to try and find any sort of remains of him. However, they never, like, to this day, really made a whole lot of headway. Some are critical of the investigation. The cigarette butts that they had collected that he was smoking were lost. They have no idea where they are, which unfortunately now we could have used for DNA evidence. Yeah,
seriously.
There was also nothing substantial that came from fingerprinting, which is odd because he had, like, touched the bourbon glass. Mm-hmm. He had touched, you know. They interviewed thousands of suspects, but were never able to actually really pinpoint somebody. In 1980, 8 years after the hijacking, a kid found 3 bundles of cash on a beach on the Columbia River. And the Columbia River, if I'm correct, which I think I am, separates Oregon and Seattle from each other. According to the FBI, the amount was over $5,000 and the serial numbers matched Cooper's haul. The bills were wet, soggy, compressed together, and had holes in them. So they were, like, you know, damaged. And interestingly enough, further investigation also concluded that the money had not been there for the full 8 years. It had somehow, so he jumped in 71.
Yeah.
It could not have been from that initial jump in 71, but it was okay. His money.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, though he pulled off a hijacking, many people in the area thought of him as a Robin Hood type figure, sticking it to a major corporation. At the time, Seattle had just gone through the Boeing bust. The company had let go of 60,000 employees, which devastated the city. The city was in such economic distress that there was a billboard there that asked the last person in Seattle to turn the lights off when they leave. Isn't that wild?
That is wild.
That's a little grim. It's possible that Cooper did not survive the jump. It was poor rainy conditions, coupled with the fact that he would not have been able to really steer the parachute well. And he very easily could have perished in the vast woodland and was never found. I mean, it's like really intense, miles upon miles upon miles of woodland. You can very easily get lost. You know, there was one guy that they interviewed on this documentary who was like basically like this woodsman himself. He had lived off the grid for a while. He was talking about how somebody had crashed a plane there 60 years prior, and they found some of his remains 60 years after the crash. Like, the woods are that fast.
Wow. Yeah. Oh my god.
So he's like, if he died in these woods, it's possible that they would never find him. However, it is also just as likely that he did survive and actually get away with it. Wikipedia has 14 potential suspects listed, but we're just going to talk about the 4 that they talked about in the documentary.
Okay.
So,
I'm so interested.
Oh my God. And honestly, I'm going to tell you about it. And I have a good amount of detail here, but you should really go and watch the documentary. It's
okay.
Very cool. So Dwayne Weber is the first suspect. Dwayne was an insurance salesman living in Florida. He and his wife, Jo, married in March of 1978, and by her account, had a very loving, wonderful marriage. He died in 1995, and while on his deathbed, he confessed to being D.B. Cooper.
Okay.
So he was he had some bad kidney disease. He took himself off dialysis. When he was in hospice care, at one point, Jo was helping him put on pants, and she asked about a scar on his knee. He said he got it jumping out of a plane. He also told her that he wanted to tell her a secret. But as he was telling her about jumping out of the plane, she kept saying that she didn't believe him. And then, you know, the doctors came in to, you know, make him feel better. And he angrily said, "Oh, fuck, let it die with me."
Come on. We can't let it die with you.
So he did continue to try and tell her the story, but he wasn't making sense. And Joe claims that one of his last words was, "I am Dan Cooper," before he passed away.
Interesting.
So a few months after his death, Joe found a wallet in the car with a fake driver's license with the name John Carlson Collins. She also learns that he had been in prison under the same name, which she like never knew about.
What?
Yeah. She also found multiple other fake IDs. Dwayne left a key to a safety deposit box for Joe. Inside the box had an article. I think it was, this part was like unclear. Like they only like half showed what the magazine said. It said soldier something on the front. Okay. And then inside there was an article that had something written on it. I don't know who wrote on it. And I think it was about D.B. Cooper. It was a man parachuting out of something. And it was titled "The Man Who Had All the Secrets." That was the only part that I was like, I don't get this part. Like, can you explain it? This one's interesting. Dwayne's tax return in 1971 showed he only made $1,000. However, he was able to buy two new cars in cash. Actually, speaking of cars, can you hear my neighbor blasting his car radio outside my door?
So I heard something and I thought it was my tenants, but now I'm wondering if it was that.
Nope, it's my neighbor. He has this really nice, like, old car. I don't know what kind of old car, but he has a nice old car that he drives around, and it's a nice day and he's driving it, and good for him. But
good for him. Get out there, buddy, and get away from our recording.
My neighbors, I love my neighbors, but they choose, they're like, oh, is Megan recording? Oh great, let me go cut my grass.
It would be the best time to make noise. Yes.
Let me go side my house, like, let me do all this stuff. So Joe had one more thing to tell us. They're literally starting to mow the lawn. I can't believe this. This is insane. Okay. We're just gonna power through. So the most compelling evidence is the memory she has of a trip to Seattle in 79. Dwayne took her around Seattle on a personalized tour. At one point, he took her to a lake and told her this is where Cooper came out of the woods. She had no idea who Cooper was, so she was like, cool, honey. I don't care about your friend. I mean, she didn't say that, but still. So on the last day, he left early in the morning and came back dirty. She assumed he was digging. After he took a bath, she took a photo of him. And at the last minute, he jumped and yelled Geronimo as if jumping out of a plane. Interesting detail, but okay.
Interesting.
He came back home with a paper bag that he said was full of trash. And he was like, I'll just get rid of it on our next stop. They had to check out of the hotel. So they went to their next stop and Dwayne threw the paper bag into the river. And Joe was pissed. She's like, why would you throw trash into the river? Like, this is gross. Don't contaminate the waterways, blah, blah, blah. So interestingly enough, the place where the boy found the money was 9 miles downstream from where Dwayne had thrown the paper bag.
Interesting.
The way that the waterways in the area work, the money couldn't have made it to the beach where the boy found it.
Yeah.
If where they assumed D.B. Cooper had initially landed, because the water just, it wouldn't have carried it that way.
Hmm.
And remember, this was 79 when they went there. The boy found it in 81. The money was not there since 71. It was there after, sometime after. I think it was after 73 is what they concluded.
Interesting.
So she believes that he had gone in search, like he had kept the money somewhere in Seattle. He went to go get it. He saw that most of it was in good shape, but not all of it was in good shape. And so he threw away the money that was not in good shape anymore and couldn't be used. So there's one person.
Interesting. Interesting.
Barbara Dayton is the second suspect. So Barbara was a transgender pilot in Washington. Before she transitioned, she was somewhat of a like cowboy. She had a wife and kids. Barbara would wear her wife's clothing on occasion, and her wife was totally cool with it. At some point, her wife began to look at her as more of a friend, which makes it makes sense.
Yeah.
She had gender reassignment surgery in 1968, and this was so sad. Her daughter was talking about it. She believe she was a freak.
Oh,
I know. I guess she had seen her daughter, like, I'm sure there was some strain in the family, because I mean, it's hard to be transgender in 2021. I can't imagine in 68.
Oh my gosh. Oh God, yeah, absolutely.
So it seemed like her daughter was very accepting of her, and I would assume her wife was pretty accepting because her wife
sounded like it.
Yeah. Which is good. But it from what I could tell, it kind of seemed like once she came out as trans, she moved away from her family a little bit.
Okay.
But I don't 100% know that. Just sure. Kind of what it seemed to be. So at some point in her life, she met Ron Foreman on an airfield in Washington and became good friends with he and his wife. She would go over for dinner every Sunday night. Whenever anyone would talk poorly about D.B. Cooper, she would get really upset and almost like defend him. On one day, Ron jokingly said, "I know who D.B. Cooper is. It's Barb." And she got wicked upset and told him to never say that again. Weeks later, Ron, Pat, Barb, God, what a bunch of like boomer names. Ron, Pat, right? And Barb all right? Hanging out.
Just chilling.
Ron, Pat, and Barb and a couple were hanging out and they were looking at a sketch of Cooper. They combed Barb's hair to the side and put sunglasses on her and took a picture. Her photograph looked strikingly similar to the sketch, so much so that no one really said anything for a minute or so. When Barb realized everyone was just staring at her in disbelief, she said that she was Cooper. The other woman who was there panicked, tore the picture up, was like convinced they were all going to jail, wanted to burn, you know, not burn the picture, but wanted to be like, get rid of this evidence, we're all going to jail, which, ma'am, it's just, relax, just take a breath, okay? Later on, she told Ron and Pat details, like that she jumped at 10,000 feet, she didn't deploy the parachute until 1,000 feet. She had used the money belt as a depth finder. Have no clue what that means, but good for nope. you. She landed in a field near Woodburn, close to the freeway, changed out of her suit and put on her wig, and then just like walked off because no one was looking for a woman.
That's wild.
Ron asked her if the bomb was real. And she said she didn't do anything phony. I was like, oh my God.
This human being is, wow. Okay, 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 okay.
Right? So Rena Ruddle, who's Barb's daughter, does believe that her father was D.B. Cooper as well. Her uncle, so Rena's uncle, Barb's brother, had seen the initial sketch of Cooper in the newspaper and looked at it and immediately knew it was Barb, but he didn't call her Barb. He called her by her dead name because he also didn't like that she was trans.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. He never really talked about it after that because he didn't approve of her hijacking a plane. Fair.
Fair.
That's also fair. Didn't approve of her being trans. Unfair.
Unfair. Correct.
So Rena also believes that her grandparents knew that Barb was Cooper because her grandmother kept a detailed diary about everything. And on Thanksgiving in 1971, her grandmother didn't write anything about Barb. And so she thinks that was a deliberate attempt to basically cover things up.
What? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So suspect number three. L.D. Cooper.
Okay.
L.D. Yeah. L.D. I think his first name was Lynn. Yeah, but he went by L.D. So he was a kind uncle to Marla Cooper, who remembers a strange story from Thanksgiving 1971 in Portland. The day before, she was walking in the woods and overheard her uncle planning something. He wouldn't tell her what it was. The next day, another uncle drove up to the house in the passenger seat was her basically unconscious Uncle LD. He was dressed in a white t-shirt and had blood all over it. She yelled for her father, who came running to the aid of his brother, and she heard her Uncle Dewey say, "Well, we did it. We hijacked the plane. Our money problems are over."
Okay.
Once the situation was settled, her father pulled her aside and told her she could not talk about it with anyone. It was a life and death circumstance. The last time she saw LD was Christmas 1972. So on Christmas 95, Marla was talking about LD with her dad because she loved this guy so much, and she was like heartbroken when she didn't see him again. So she was talking about him with her dad, and her dad was like, "I'm not totally sure where he is, but I think he might still be hiding." And she was like, "What?" And
my God.
When she asked who he was hiding from, he was like, the authorities, the FBI, the CIA, because he hijacked the plane. You remember, you were there. And she had apparently blocked out this memory and it started to come back to her. And her father called her like a couple more times to talk to her and be like, you know, like you saw the aftermath of the hijacking when he came back to the house. But unfortunately, her dad dies a few months after this.
What?
Yeah. In 2011, she talked to the FBI about what happened and took a polygraph test, which she passed.
Interesting.
They were so satisfied with her answers, they wanted to close the case.
What?
Mm-hmm. Now, there is this one interesting piece. I was like, oh my gosh, she passed a polygraph. Somebody else brought up the point in the documentary that, well, of course she passed the polygraph because she believes what she's saying. And I was
fair. Yep.
So that one was kind of wild. And then the fourth suspect is Richard Floyd McCoy. Richard was an engineer in the National Guard and had served in Vietnam, receiving multiple medals during his service. In 1972, he hijacked a Boeing airplane from Denver to Los Angeles under the alias James Johnson. He had a remarkably similar plan to D.B. Cooper and was actually called a copycat of the Cooper case.
Wow.
Some people think he is Cooper and he just got better. So he used a note, a handgun, and a hand grenade demanding $500,000. He got the money and parachuted out of the plane, knowing how to deploy the stairs, something Cooper had a hard time with, so maybe he learned from it.
Interesting.
His friend and former roommate when he was in the National Guard, Ben... this kills me. They didn't pronounce his name, and I feel really bad. Ben A. We're going to go with Ben A, because...
Ben A works.
Edgeweirden. I just can't read. Okay. So his friend and former roommate, Ben Edgeweirden, saw the composite sketch and recognized him and reported it to the FBI. The FBI searched McCoy's home. They found the $500,000 minus one $20 bill for lunch.
Ah, yes.
Poor guy. He only got to spend $20. So, and then Ben was saying that he had talked to McCoy later. And McCoy was like, dude, some of the money was for you. And Ben was like, why didn't you tell me beforehand? Like, you know, jokingly, obviously. Yeah. I don't want to, like, incriminate this poor guy. I was joking.
No, of course.
And Ben also talked about how when they were rooming together in the National Guard, they had talked out scenarios of, like, how they would hijack a plane. And Ben was like, I was never serious. I would just, you know, talk about this stuff. Because, I mean, in fairness, they were military guys. They would plan stuff like that. They would plan attacks and whatnot. Yeah. And so he was like, oh, we'd talk it through and talk about it. And then he just did it. Okay, sure. A little uncomfy there. But so he was arrested, I believe, in his home in Salt Lake City. So enter Bernie Rhodes, who is a cop from Salt Lake City that interviewed him. And Bernie is still going strong in the documentary. He was, at least. He is very feisty old man. I enjoyed him on the documentary. But he is convinced that McCoy is D.B. Cooper. During the interview, McCoy didn't deny that he was Cooper. He just wouldn't talk about it. He would look at the sketch, wouldn't really touch it. He would try and, like, avoid it, had a little bit of an emotional reaction to it, which Rhodes found kind of odd, and seemed unnatural to him. He was also just like, when I was looking at him, I just had this sense that it was him. He kind of looked like the sketch, or he looked a lot like the sketch. So when he was asked about the Cooper hijacking, McCoy said that he was home that night. However, there's gas receipts and phone call logs that put him in Las Vegas that night. So he may have committed the second hijacking 5 months later because he dropped a lot of the money. There were no zippers or handles on the bag that he got the money in, so he could have easily dropped it in the air. Bernie believes that he went to Vegas with the $8,000 to $10,000 that he could hold on to and laundered the money at casinos and then was able to go home the next day. And then 5 months later, he did the second hijacking because he only got to keep like $10,000.
Interesting.
So McCoy was sentenced to 45 years in prison. He didn't like that. He escaped the next day. He was then caught. He then escaped again. And unfortunately, he died in a shootout with police.
Oh, jeez.
So I guess somebody does die.
Yeah. But. Okay. Yep. But not in the initial crime.
No. So one man who was interviewed in the documentary, his name is Jeffrey Gray. He was actually able to see the Cooper case file, the FBI case file. And he was like so excited to see it. But he said that there's very little of anything to help in that case file. Like there's minimal actual evidence. It's mostly filled with letters from people accusing people in their lives of being Cooper.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So as of July 12, 2016, the FBI decided to kind of close the case in order to focus resources, manpower, and time on other investigations. So they just like rerouted resources in that case to other things.
Sure.
Which makes sense because Cooper at the time was a middle-aged man, a middle-aged white man, and they thought he was like in his 40s maybe. He's either no longer alive or very old.
Yeah. Yes.
And it would be very hard to track him down.
Sure. And like, yes, like this crime was like, you know, hijacking a plane and doing all that is horrible. Nobody died. It like, and at this point it's almost like a like it doesn't feel real. It feels like folklore at this point that this actually happened.
Yep.
What, so based on like, it's interesting that so many people, like there's so many potential possibilities, like of like, cause this crime is so outrageous, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's so, it's crazy that there's even that many like potential suspects. Based on your research and like all those potential suspects, do you have like a theory?
Oh, see, this is hard because I did. Like when I was watching it and they were introducing the suspects, I really thought it was LD because okay. I was like, I mean, there's literally somebody who witnessed him come back Thanksgiving Day. He's covered in blood. He disappears for like umpteen years. Your father is like, you remember that he hijacked the plane. Like your father's scared to death telling you can't tell anybody. Like that to me is interesting.
Yep.
I don't know that I totally know that it's Barbara Dayton mm-hmm. because part of me, I don't know how to say this. I guess a part of me feels like because she was transgender
mm-hmm.
and she clearly felt like a freak and she felt like an outcast. Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of sounded like these friends would talk to her, but like, ah, you're a DB Cooper, aren't you? Ah, you're a DB.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like she finally was just like, fuck it. You know what? I'll give you a good story.
Totally. I could totally see that perspective. I also, so in the, on the other hand, like, because this crime was so outrageous, can you imagine, like, if you just think about, like, what this person went through, like, and then transitioned and then, like, did all this mm-hmm. stuff, like, that makes, that if she was DB Cooper, like, that story is incredible because of, like, the like just how that story plays out is just like wow, like that would be incredible. But yeah, you're probably right, like she was probably like, yeah, sure, like yeah, I'm DB Cooper, fine.
I mean, I suppose, you know, if anyone has the smarts to get away with it, it is a woman.
It is true. This is true. And well, she was the only woman who it could have potentially have been.
Yeah, I just I don't know, like a piece of me is like, I just get the feeling that it almost sounded like she was like badgered a little bit. Maybe she wasn't. Maybe I'm wrong. And she just was kind of like, you know, because you know how we all get to a point where it's like, you know, if somebody accuses you of cheating, it gets to the point where it's like, why am I fucking fighting it? I might as well just say, yeah, you know what? I'm cheating. You didn't cheat, but you're like, yeah, whatever. Fine. You win. Good for you. Like, I can't fight this anymore. Kind of.
I can totally see that.
the Dwayne Weber, it is the throwing the bag and finding the money nearby is interesting, especially because that money wasn't there in 71. Like, that is definitely interesting to me. But, and I know, like, the tax returns and he bought the cars, but mm-hmm, if this mm-hmm. man has multiple identities, he probably has bank accounts.
Yeah.
I think we don't know what he went to jail for. You know what I mean? And
yeah, I
that's also an interesting story, because I didn't say this when I was talking about the case, but Joe has a guy, Tim, who is like a son to her, and they're very close, and she calls him her memory man, because apparently, like, he grew up close to where D.B. Cooper would have landed, or, you know, whatever. He grew up in Washington, and it's always fascinated him. So when he heard about her, like, they would talk a lot, and he's like, oh, I just, like, piece stuff together for her in her memory. And so that to me is a little like, okay, like, fair, like, maybe.
Interesting.
I don't know. The other thing that's kind of tricky is we're working with memories from 50 years ago now. This would have been 50 years this year. This is hard. Like, even, you know, like, Marla, like, I'm trying to think back to when I was 8 years old. And number one, you're seeing it from an 8-year-old perspective. And two, like, I don't know that I could remember. The only thing that gets me with her is her dad in 95 is telling her she's correct.
Yeah.
And then the Richard McCoy one does hold some weight for me, because he did it again.
Yes.
He did it a little bit better.
Yes. Which means that he could have potentially learned, like you were saying.
Right. And the only other thing too was that I also didn't say this, because I'm just piecing this together now. Tina Mucklow, who was sitting next to Cooper, when she was talking to him at one point, he said, I'm not getting out alive. Or I'm not, basically, like, I'm not going to jail. Like, they won't catch me alive. And McCoy escaped from prison twice. That's kind of the same mentality of, like, granted, he surrendered initially at his home.
Sure.
But that mentality of, like, I'm not, you know,
I'm not giving in to the authorities. Quietly. Yeah.
And the only reason he was caught was because his friend saw the sketch. And you have to kind of think, like, maybe it was a little bit better of a sketch. You know, maybe the friend didn't, like, see it in 71 for whatever reason. Like, that is the only reason he got caught, was because his, well, assuming, because that's what they made it sound like on the documentary. It's the only reason he got caught was because his friend reported it.
Yep. Totally. So, interesting. That's so fascinating.
Yeah. Do you have any ones that you think?
No, I feel overwhelmed by all of those options.
I know it's
but
so much.
What I was gonna say is, if anybody has watched the new Loki series, so in one of the episodes, this doesn't give anything away, but they show that what Loki did at some point during his life is he was D.B. Cooper, and
oh,
they show
God.
Him jump. It was really, really funny.
That is cool.
Yeah, it was kind of neat, but. Wow. I'm fascinated by that case, because it's so mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
It almost just, like I said, it feels like folklore at this point.
He kind of is a folk hero.
Yeah.
For a while, a lot of people looked up to him and were like, yeah, like, that was well thought out and executed. And in fairness, like, I know that they're like, piracy is not a victimless crime. And I feel bad. Like, the flight attendant
for sure.
Was very scared. Those pilots were very scared.
Oh, I'm sure they were
terrified. That's traumatizing, and I'm glad they're okay. But, I mean, the man stole a bunch of money. It's not, like, the worst crime that could have... It's the worst crime for billionaires, but it's not the worst crime.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow. That is so cool. Thank you for covering that case.
Yeah, it is a cool case. I enjoyed that.
So, I was actually so excited, because I already knew what I wanted to cover when I knew that you were doing this, because we talked about this up front at the top, but I really wanted to cover the history of plumbing of Seattle. And that
oh,
sounds like,
yes.
That sounds like, to people who don't know this, this sounds like the most boring thing ever, but just wait. Literally the funniest story. The first time I came back from Seattle or the when I originally heard this when I came back from Seattle, I told this story at like every party I went to because I think it is so hysterical. So here we go. So this is from leakmasters.net.
It sounds appropriate for
it plumbing. Does sound appropriate. So in the field of water leak detection, Seattle has some of the best services available anywhere in the United States. But that wasn't always the case. A look back at the history of plumbing in the city shows how far local residents have come since the founding fathers arrived. In the beginning, there was mud. So the underground ruins of old Seattle still exist. And while they're a tourist attraction these days, they have mainly the mundane issues of plumbing to thank for their origins. So founded initially on low, muddy flats of Puget Sound back in 1851, Seattle had little in the way of plumbing to start with. Residents used outhouses or privies for their toilet needs, and water was hauled in from the nearby Elliott Bay for flushing, washing, and cooking purposes. So the arrival of the crapper. So late in the 1800s, a man named Thomas Crapper. You heard that right. His last name is Crapper.
I mean, what came first? Crapper.
I mean,
that's like the real chicken or the
that's egg. The real chicken or the egg question right there. He brought an invention to Seattle, which replaced the outhouse in the homes of the wealthy. The device named the Crapper after its founder. Oh my God. So this makes me think that Thomas Crapper came before crap.
I was actually like thinking that, and I wanted to ask that question, but I also didn't want to ask that question because we were also on the tour with a bunch of high schoolers.
Oh God. I'm sure they thought this was the funniest thing ever. So the crapper needed to be connected to a central sewage system. Early plumbers developed a single wooden box pipe to draw the waste from the crapper to the bay. Oh, yeah. No. So gross, guys. Like literally pumping sewage into the bay.
This is why when people are like, I love old timeies, they think of like the 1920s and on.
Yes, exactly. You were not remembering the 1800s. So the point at which it entered the water at the tip of the bay was known as West Point and eventually became the location for the first wastewater treatment plant. So flooded homes and exploding toilets. Oh my! So life that close to the water had its drawbacks. However, and one was that twice a day when the tide came in, a number of homes throughout the residential area were at risk for flooding. So remember, the sewage system was connected to the bay. So the tide would go out and then the tide would come in. So when that happened, the sewage in the drains from the privies would flow back into the homes and explode out of the toilets.
Oh, so bad.
Drenching anyone within range. Exploding crappers, people. So imagine you're just going to the bathroom, sitting on your crapper, and all of a sudden, here comes the tide straight up the butt.
Here comes the boom.
Literally shoot you off the toilet. So the Seattle Department of Engineers in 1892 annual report speaks of quote unquote night soil, aka sewage.
Oh God.
From the business district being collected by horse-drawn wagons.
Business district,
right? Being taken to Elliott Bay waterfront where it was towed several miles out and dumped. So making progress. So Seattle residents began making plumbing progress around 1870 when the first indoor bathroom was installed. The engineering department, this came from the engineering department. So only the wealthy could afford private indoor plumbing, but personal hygiene was becoming more widespread by the 1880s. Most Amen. Of Seattle homes had basins in their bathrooms. So actually this was really interesting. So After the fire that almost destroyed Seattle in 1889, founding fathers rebuilt in the same place on the mud flats within a few years. Property owners built 8-foot walls on either side of the sidewalks and filled them in to raise the street level up to the second story of buildings, mostly because of the water problems. So this is what created those then future underground tunnels and gave the city its first economic boom that resulted in establishment of plumbing companies to serve the growing market. So basically, because they were able to build higher, they weren't having this exploding crapper problem anymore. When they talk about this economic boom that happened, this was actually largely in relation to sex work that was happening inside of the underground tunnels. They just don't want to call that out here. They called them like seamstresses or something, I think.
Yes, right? That's what they called them. And actually, gosh, it was a woman from San Francisco that had come up, and it's Madam Something. And she was so awesome. She actually, when she passed away, she left the largest sum of money to the public school system that was not beaten until Bill and Melinda Gates.
Incredible. Incredible. Sex work is real work, guys. And they really, you know,
and they support the public schools.
Yep. I mean, like, literally nobody else does. So,
so sad. Thank God it's July.
Thank God. So yeah, so that I wanted to make sure that I covered the exploding crappers. So you can tell your friends Seattle has exploding crappers. It's a great story. They now have good plumbing. But the exploding crappers led to, well, actually the fire is what led to not having exploding crappers anymore. But Seattle has a very interesting history, guys. Very interesting. So I'm so glad that I could talk about exploding crappers once more.
I know you were very excited for that before I went on the tour.
I was so excited.
I just remember before we were, like, the last time we were recording, you were like, there was poop. I'm not going to ruin it. And I was like, what in God's name are they going to talk about on this tour?
Such a good story. Oh, man. And they do a really good job telling it, honestly, better than I just did, because it's a great story.
100%. Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode, because we certainly did.
We certainly did. This was a really fun one.
And we will see you next time.
Yeah, see you next time. Hit us up on the gram. Thanks for listening to Fancytown Crimes. Our cover art and editing is by me, Taylor Adams. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Fancytown Crimes. If you have questions, answers, or recommendations to share with us, email us at fancytowncrimespodcast@gmail.com. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, basically wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you like this show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way to spread the news. If you'd like to show your support and get a shout out on air, visit our Patreon page to keep this podcast and the shenanigans going.